Another day is here, and you're ready for it. What to wear? Check. Breakfast, lunch, and dinner? Check. Planning for what's next and how to save for it? That's where Bank of America can help. For your financial to-dos, Bank of America has experts ready to help get you closer to your goals. Get started at one of our local financial centers or 24-7 in our mobile banking app. Find a location near you at bankofamerica.com/talktous. What would you like the power to do? Mobile banking requires downloading the app and is only available for select devices. Message and data rates may apply. Bank of America NA, member FDIC.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Hey, I'm Paul Stevenson, and this is the Ultimate Classic Rock Podcast that says that my music is better than yours. Make sure to subscribe on your podcast app so that you don't miss a single episode. They come out each Monday, and as always, they feature big-name rock stars that found fame in the 60s, 70s, or 80s. If you're a new listener, check back through the catalogue. There's an awful lot of interviews for you to enjoy with the stars telling their stories from throughout their careers. Now, today, though, it's something a little bit different. Yes, we still have a big-name guest, a Rock and Roll Hall of Fame inductee, but it's someone we've had on the podcast a couple of times already, a man who, along with Mark Knopfler, was the only other ever-present member of Dire Straits, one of the biggest-selling bands of all time, with record sales of over 100 million. They spent 1,100 weeks on the UK album chart, which is the fifth most of all time. They won 4 Grammys, 3 Brit Awards, 2 MTV Video Awards, and blessed us with classic songs such as Sultans of Swing, Money for Nothing, and Romeo and Juliet, plus blockbuster albums like Brothers in Arms, Love Over Gold, and their self-titled debut. My guest today is, of course, the wonderful John Ilsley. But as I've said, I've already spoken to John a couple of times. Go back and check out episode 2 and an episode called Side 2, My Life in Dire Straits, both with John telling his stories from his career. And while you're scrolling, if you are a big fan of Dire Straits, then I've also interviewed the group's original drummer, Pick Withers, and keyboard player Alan Clark as well. So plenty of Dire Straits material for you if you're a fan. Go back and give them a listen. Now, my reason for getting John on today was to launch a fun new series of the show called My 5 Favourite. This is pretty much what it sounds like. I speak with these wonderful rock stars and we discuss their 5 favourite somethings to do with music. And I'm delighted to say today's show features John Ilsley exclusively revealing his 5 favourite songs from Dire Straits. But it's not just a quick rundown. We hear about the stories behind his selections, the meanings behind them, the writing and the recording processes, the changing dynamics in the band with members leaving and joining, and what the songs each mean to John as well. I've also got a few other big name guests recorded so far, revealing their 5 favourites too, so they will appear in coming weeks, along with so many other big name classic rock stars. Honestly, I've been like an interviewing machine lately. I've got so many in the bag, so I'm really looking forward to you hearing them all. But back to John then, and it's a fascinating insight into what he thinks of the band's own back catalogue, something we don't often get to hear from these superstars. And before we chat about the songs, we get a little catch up with him. We speak about Tina Turner, who, as we all know, sadly passed away recently, but John and the rest of Dire Straits worked with her on her smash hit song Private Dancer, so we hear about that, plus about his solo work as well. So lots to chat about indeed. Now, I hope you enjoy this show. It's something completely different, so if you do like it, please mention it to your friends or family, co-workers, you know the drill. Word of mouth always seems to be the best way to spread the news, although if you do have social media, sharing links on there also helps as well. Thank you very much. Right, so here we go. Let's find out what Dire Straits legend John Ilsley rates as his 5 favourite Dire Straits songs of all time. Now, quickly before we start, I'd just like to touch on someone that we sadly lost a couple of months ago, the legendary Tina Turner, wonderful performer, wonderful singer, wonderful lady, and someone that you actually worked with, wasn't it?
Indeed. Yes, she was a force to be reckoned with, that's for certain, not only when she was performing, but as I discovered when we were recording, because we did... The Private Dancer with her. Well, all of the band except for Mark, actually. He was busy doing a soundtrack somewhere. And so the band got a chance to play with Tina. Yes, It was quite a moment because, you know, one's been in the recording studio many times, but not in the presence of somebody like Tina Turner when she decides to virtually give you a private concert singing this song with you while you are playing it together. And it was like she was singing in front of 20,000 people. It was quite an extraordinary performance. So I think she got the vocal like in two takes or something. That was it.
Wow.
But it was lovely, actually, just, you know, being in her presence and playing a song, which, of course, we all knew quite well because we'd rehearsed it ourselves with the possible intention of playing it on the road. But it didn't seem to be appropriate suddenly for Mark to be singing a song called Private Dancer and with the words, as we know, a bit weird. But anyway, that's the story. And a great pleasure. I've met her before because we did the Prince's Trust concerts on a couple of occasions with the Queen, as we called her, the Queen of Rock. Yeah.
And what was the aura like around her when she was just like in your presence?
Well, you know, it's like a lot of people you meet who have this this fame, if you like. They're so well known. When you actually meet them, and it happens on a number of occasions on the over the years, you find them to be pretty, I'm not going to use the word ordinary, but not kind of unusual, apart from the fact that they're very talented in what they do, and either as guitar players or writers. They just have a particular gift. But when you're in conversation with people like that, generally speaking, it's like talking to, you know, chatting to you in a sense. They're just other people.
Yeah.
I'm simple as. There are exceptions of people who don't give much away, but they protect themselves, which is understandable.
Indeed. And you talk there about having worked in the studio with her and the force of nature and everything like that. You did actually get to have a meal. Was it a curry, I think you said, that you got to spend the evening with?
Well, we had a takeaway curry brought in, actually, because she wanted that. And personally, I'm not a great curry eater. I probably eat about 3 or 4 a year. But I think for Tina, it was that's what she ate. And so we just joined in, and it was very nice to sort of do a recording session. I think we were there for a few hours, just after lunchtime for a few hours, and we finished early evening. So she said, "Do you guys want a curry?" And we said, "Yeah, sure, let's have a curry." So, just like that.
wonderful stuff. Yeah. Now I've had the pleasure of chatting with you, John, many times over the years, and I think the last time we spoke was about 18 months ago, and it was just after the release of your book, My Life in Dire Straits, and that one seemed to work fantastically well, and it was just before the release of your 8th studio album, 8 as well, that came out a month or so after we spoke last. So let's talk about that. Are you happy with the way the album was received and the results of it that came out?
Well, this album actually has done, has attracted more attention, I think, than the others. Partly because one of the songs on there, Long Way Back, we did a video for it, and that seems to have attracted an awful lot of attention. I don't know what on the last count, I mean, but 7 million people have watched it or something, which for me is quite a lot. It's not up to the Dire Straits standard, but I think that makes a big difference these days, that sort of presence on these digital formats and such like, which of course we're all starting to have to get used to. So that, I think that's helped a lot. I was just about to make a phone call before I remembered we had to talk and I was busy doing things. I just remembered I've got to talk to the record company and see actually if they have got it moving around in America, because I think it would work there very well, but it's been very well received, Ate, and I play the songs at concerts, and they seem to go down very well. But then, you know, I've got 70 odd songs of my own out there now, and then, you know, 60 or 70 songs of Dire Straits. You've got 140 songs to choose from. It's like, oh my God, where do we start? And I think if I have a problem, what does Bob Dylan have as a problem? You know,
absolutely. And you, the record came out, did fantastically well. You mentioned the concerts, and you did a small tour of the UK, didn't you? So you mentioned America as well. So is that something you'd love to do? Go over to America and play some shows over there?
Well, I'd love to. I just these days it's a question of finding the right promoter, somebody who wants to entertain the idea. It's a lot of work to get these things together now because there's a lot of bands out there playing, a lot of venues that are booked up well in advance. One has to plan way ahead, and we are now planning to try and do something in Europe next year, and hopefully in Australia and New Zealand. Wow. So we're looking into that. I think, yeah, I love touring. I love performing, and I really enjoy the, as you know, we've talked about it before, that sort of relationship between the audience and the band. And I've got some great players, and we work very well together. So it's a real pleasure still to do it.
Definitely, that's the main thing. And just mentioning Eight and the success of it so far, have you been working on any new music with prospects for a forthcoming record?
Oh well, that's always a bit of a difficult question to answer because I'm really still mystified actually how I ever get any albums together at all. But and I don't know how other people write. I hear various versions of the approach to writing, but. It's difficult. It gets more difficult, coming up with something interesting principally for oneself before you actually start showing it to anybody else. I think that's the key. And, one comes up with lots of ideas and, some things work and some things get put away for later. And I have the iPhone ready with me all the time. If I'm strumming the guitar, I might come across a few nice chord changes that are going to work somehow. So it's as I said this before, it's a sort of massive jigsaw puzzle of words and ideas I put down in a book. Every now and again, I pick the book up and I write things down. And I think everybody does that, really. And then somehow or other, it's a bit of a mystery, a bit of a fascinating thing, but somehow or other, something comes out of all that.
Fantastic.
And I don't really, it's still a mystery. There was a very interesting little snippet on social media the day with Bob Dylan talking about very early days of when he was writing. I don't know whether you saw it.
No, I've not seen that, no.
But it's very interesting because he was asked, about those early days when he first started to put songs together. And he just said, I have no idea at all how that happened. I just have no idea. I just can't imagine how all that stuff came together. I said, I just don't do it like that anymore. I don't know where they came from, those songs. I have no idea. He said, but then you go and pick up Rough and Rowdy Ways, and it's a wonderful bit of music and a bit wonderful bit of writing. So, everybody has a sort of different way of looking at their work. And he's had plenty of work.
he certainly has indeed and so have Dire Straits, and that's the reason we're talking today. It's a new little series we've got called My Five Favorite, and John, you've agreed to list your five favorite Dire Straits songs. Now, as you said, it's not an easy thing to do. There's certainly a load of songs that you guys have worked on over the years, and you've played most of them live, and they resonate so much with fans and the audiences, both young and old as well. So these songs are personal to you. These are your choices, your collection of tracks that mean something to you and really stand out amongst the Dire Straits collection. So let's start with number one. What was the first song you chose from your five?
I think it was Wild West End. For me, it was a recollection of that time when Mark and I were hanging out a lot, not only at the flat musically, working things out, and he was writing and all this, but we used to make regular visits up to the West End, to Soho. And Soho in 1976 was a little different than it is now. It was a bit more edgy. There was a lot of sort of clubs and sort of strip joints and stuff like that. And so we used to go up there, and because we enjoyed that edginess of the place, but also because there were some wonderful guitar shops up there where we could drool in the windows at things that we couldn't possibly afford. And so we used to go up there and have a bowl of pasta at the Barocco bar, and go and get coffee from Angelucci's. And it's a lovely memory for me of that beginning of Mark and I's friendship, I think, really. So I've always had a very soft spot for it. In fact, absolutely, I'm going to play it at a gig in 2 weeks' time, because it brings back a really lovely memory of that relationship with him developing, and it stood the test of time. So that's the reason I've chosen that one.
And Mark's obviously a wonderful storyteller, and he paints pictures with his words. And this is a really good early example of that, isn't it?
Yes. I mean, I think storytelling is the essence of good songwriting, unless you just want to sing about love and hate that kind of personal, really personal stuff. And this is a personal thing, but it's telling a story about, you know, building a picture of a time. And that's a very good craft. So, I mean, I've learned a lot from his writing, and Long Way Back, for instance, from the new album, is painting a picture of when we first went to LA. So I understand that way, that approach to trying to communicate something to somebody else, in a unique way. So it's a talent, but it's something that I think one can learn, over a period of time. So Wild West End is, an example, a perfect example of very early storytelling. Well, actually, if you listen to the whole first album, it's a story. I think that's probably why people tend to sort of latch onto that as being, because it is, I don't really think about it in these sort of terms, but people say to me, well, that really is the seminal kind of Dire Straits record, because it at the very beginning, it showed the sort of the energy that the band had.
So Wild West End, that was the first choice. Your second choice is another one off that debut album as well, isn't it?
Six Blade Knife, isn't it?
That's the one, yep.
Well, it's interesting. You see, there's a thing, the Six Blade Knife is a Swiss Army knife, as you probably know, which has got all the necessary things on it. The most necessary one, of course, being a corkscrew to open a bottle of wine, and a little thing that takes the cap off a tin. It does a feast of things, the six-blade knife. So I've got two or three of them, actually, quite old ones, because I had one very early, and I think Mark bought me one in that first time. And so here's another example of using an article like that and then, relating it to a relationship. You take away my heart, like you take away the top of a tin, something. I can't remember the exact words now. Of course, I've forgotten them naturally. But, a synonymous sort of idea about a relationship and a tool. So it's very clever. And I've always loved the really the simplicity of it is so easy. And funnily enough, it's my daughter Dee's one of her favorite Dire Straits songs. She plays it constantly, even though she listens to music all the time. Every time she comes to the house, I can hear it in her room just playing.
Yep.
It sort of plods along rather nicely, but it's just a very sweet and sort of simple way of expressing an idea.
Yeah, I like that, because it's a rather sparse song. It proves that you don't have to overplay. It just kind of fills nicely and rolls nicely. It's a bit like, it always reminds me of Dreams by Fleetwood Mac, that kind of thing, that kind of rolling beats and things. And yeah, definitely.
Well, I think you've touched on something there. I think the early feeling of the band was on that simplicity, what you can do with two guitars and a bass and a drum kit. And if you can make that work, well, actually, a good song should be able to play. You can play it on an acoustic guitar, but when you've just got a four piece, you have to. Everything's a bit simpler. There were very, very few overdubs on that first record.
Ooh.
Yeah, and most of it was played live, and just with you know, obviously the vocals were done afterwards and the car harmonies and stuff like that, and a bit of tidying up, bit of lead guitar work. But principally, you know, yeah, it was very, very simple.
And two songs you've picked from your top five that have come from that first record. Yeah. A silly question, but obviously it's something that you look back on fondly.
Very much so. I think, it was the first time we'd actually ever been in a grown-up studio.
Pathway was very small.
Pathways, well, they're so small, you can only get two people in the mixing room, you know, the recording. Yes, it was wonderful studio, Basing Street, just off Portobello. I think that just being together in a place where you could really hear what you were doing, the sound coming back from you seemed to be better than the sound you were making, if you like, because the equipment, it was very top drawer. And of course, Muff Winwood did a wonderful job of producing it, and Brett Davis, a great engineer. We had a very good team, and they basically, Muff Winwood would say to us, "Right, guys, I can hear how simply you play. Please don't overcomplicate it right now. Just keep it really simple." And that's what we did, and that's what the album is. It's a very simple acknowledgement of where we were at that particular time in 1977.
Fantastic. Right, we're going to jump through a couple of records now and go to Making Movies for your third choice. And this one was a big hit. It was a top 10 single in the UK. And you talk about simplicity. It is another kind of stripped back song, but it is very complex in its playing and wordplay as well. It's a great song. So what is choice number three then, John?
Well, Romeo and Juliet. And I chose this really because you're right. It seems on the surface to be a very simple, simple song. But in fact, actually, I've played it with quite a few people. And now in my band, I've got people who really understand how it works. Mm-hmm. So it's got a lot of subtleties in there, which are not obvious at any one time to a lot of people who hear it and tend to miss the dynamic, the very subtle dynamic in that song. And of course, it's a love song, and it's a frustrating love song. And I don't even know, and I don't really want to think about what Mark was going through at that particular point in time. And it might have been a reflection of where he was at. I knew him pretty well, but I didn't know everything. And so I would imagine it was either fictitious or with a bit of, personal history there. It doesn't really matter. The fact of the matter is, as soon as people hear that song, I can hear a sort of murmur in the audience, and they go, "Oh yes, we really want to hear this." And it's a wonderful piece of work, even though I say it myself. and I adore playing it. I adore singing it. And I've got a lovely girl in the band called Hannah Robinson, who is a singer-songwriter in her own right, and she will be known at some point. And I get her to sing the second verse. Oh, and everybody afterwards says, "Oh, that girl of yours, she's got a fantastic voice." And I think, yes, she has. She's the only one in the band with a fantastic voice. and they really pick it out because she sings it with such tenderness. And I recommend that to anybody if they've got a girl in their band, to let them sing the second verse. But anyway, yes, it's a wonderful song. I remember the very first time that I heard it. Mark came to my place in Forest Hill, house in Forest Hill. He bought his National Steel guitar around, and he tuned it in a very strange way. And everybody knows who's tried to play that song will know the tuning is interesting, and actually, it's actually quite a difficult thing to play, for any guitar player, and a lot of them just give up. It's a very, very interesting piece of guitar playing, which when you see Mark playing it, it looks like it's water off a duck's back. But in fact, actually, it's very tricky, and a lot of people have been defeated by it, dare I say. But he came and he played the very, very raw version of that to me, and I just looked at him and I said, "That's just fantastic. That is one of the best things I think I've heard you make, mate. That's just wonderful. That's going to be so great to record. And I was right. It's meant a lot to a lot of people. I think somebody said one day, I wonder how many babies have been born or created from Romeo and Juliet. Anyway, moving right along.
We will leave that one there. Just quickly discussing the period around that then. Obviously, there was a period of change because David left during the making of that record and Hal and Alan Clark joined for the tour and things like that. The band was evolving. It was changing. How was the feeling within the group at this stage then? Because obviously you'd had success from the previous records and this was another great album you just recorded. So how was the feeling within the group with the dynamics changing?
Well, it's a sad thing, but dynamics in bands do change, and it's very rare for a band to start off as a four piece and end as a four piece. It was a very difficult time. I dealt with it in the book in the best way I could, because I was very friendly with David, and obviously Mark was my great mate. And so it was very difficult to deal with that situation in many ways. But in a sense, the band really didn't have any alternative. The only way that the band was going to move forward and do what it could really do, which we did, was by, unfortunately, David leaving. And it was a very sad day for me, a sad day for Mark as well, that didn't work out. But that's life. And, sometimes it happens, these things.
They certainly do. Right, let's go on to choice four then. And this certainly is an epic. We're going to Love Over Gold now.
Yes. This was quite a song to get together. Going back to the Making Movies time, when we toured Making Movies, we actually, during the sound check of Making Movies, we actually spent the time getting A Telegraph Road together. It was obviously a lot of piano work with Alan Clark and Mark together, and then getting all those different dynamics in the music, because it's obviously, we know it's very long, and it's there again. It's a story. We're telling a story about that. That road in America. I think it was around Detroit or something. I can't remember exactly.
Yeah, I think you're right. Yeah,
I think the idea came from a book, but I don't know. But anyway, so he developed this whole kind of nature, this idea of the growth of America and this long road and the Telegraph Road and all the rest of it. And wonderful, yet again, another wonderful piece of writing. And it took a long time to get that together, but we used the sound checks, as I say, on the Making Movies tour, partly to stop ourselves getting bored, but because we needed to get this song and a few other songs together for the next record, because at that time the work intensity was phenomenal. We didn't really stop at all. Mm-hmm. And so, you toured and you took a couple of weeks off or three, and then you went straight into recording again. And then you organized the next tour and so on. So this was, we had to work on these songs while we were on the road. So when we got to the power station in New York, we were ready to put that song down. And, recording a 14-minute song, let me tell you, in one crack is quite an experience. Yeah.
And absolutely. And in terms of the last 4 or 5 minutes then, I mean, how is that as a musician when you're on stage and you've gone through 9-10 minutes of the song and you get to this last 4 or 5 minutes and it really is a big jam? It must be really fun as a musician to feel that energy and really get to play that last bit.
Oh my God. I mean, I used to look forward to that every single night, and I think we captured it on Alchemy.
Yeah.
I think that was the band was really hot at that particular point in time on that Alchemy tour. And I think there was a Making Movies tour. That version, I think, of Telegraph is pretty phenomenal. I mean, you're quite right, towards the end when it starts to really motor, after that you had to play something a bit quieter and a bit slower. But I used to look forward to that every night, and especially the end when we started building the thing up and it just gets more and more, and you think, And Mark's guitar playing at that particular moment was just quite phenomenal. I mean, I look back on it now and I think, oh my God, I sometimes you get so used to things happening. But when I go back and listen to that, I'm thinking, it's just phenomenal, absolutely phenomenal guitar playing. Quite extraordinary every single night, this musicianship of unparalleled energy, really. And that's why people used to come and watch the band playing live, because it was bloody good.
It certainly was. It certainly it was.
Good, you know, yeah. We prided ourselves on doing good concerts and, you know, satisfying a lot of eager ears.
You certainly did that. And you mentioned that after playing that song that you had to play something a little bit quieter, and that's moving us on to choice number five now. I spoke to you, I think it was maybe 3 or 4 years ago now, and I pinned you down to your favorite Dire Straits song, and it's no surprise that this one made the list. You said it was an almost perfect song that Mark had written. So your choice for number five comes from the Brothers in Arms album.
Yes, well, I think that most Dire Straits aficionados would rank this pretty high. Brothers in Arms is an attempt to, if you like, open people's eyes and minds to the frustrations and horrors of, conflict, and how we try and deal with it. I mean, we're in one right now, although it's now sort of on the second page of the Bloody Telegraph or something. You know, this business of people just disagree about things and start hurting each other. And I still find it really difficult to comprehend, though we haven't really moved on very much over the centuries. There's still megalomaniacs and idiots who think they can change the world to the better, and basically makes it worse, essentially. So Brothers in Arms, I always find it very emotional to play it. Even now, I've played it thousands and thousands of times, and I make no excuse for the other day I finished off a concert with it. And it's an interesting thing when you, because most people finish a concert, and I often do, with something hard and fast, and you know, so everybody's on their feet with their hands in the air. And I think I made no apologies. I said, I'm going to finish this concert with this song because I think it still has resonance and an important sort of message to the world still. And I think it will forever.
Yeah.
Dare I say? I think it's, you know, there are some artworks that are on the wall that, you know, people recognize as being significant aspects of human integrity. And I think Brothers in Arms fits into that with, you know, in the musical world.
And how soon into the recording of the entire record was it decided that that song and the title itself stood out so much that it had to be the name of the record itself?
I think it was pretty obvious right from the start, actually. You know, because in a sense, Brothers in Arms is a term, a colloquial term for people being together, and not particularly in conflict. But I do know that it's the signature tune of the armed forces when they're away. I mean, they play it a lot, and I've had messages, and I suspect Mark has too, from a lot of ex-army guys. I mean, I've had a ride back in a taxi the other day in London, and he was talking about this, that his time in Iraq and all the rest of it. And there he is driving a cab. And he said, you know, I said, did you ever listen to music? I thought I'll just tease him a bit. I said, did you ever listen to music while you were over there? And he said, well, yes. I mean, we listened to Brothers in Arms a lot because it meant so much to us at that particular time where we were. And I said, well, I played the bass on that. And he almost jammed his foot on the brake to, you know, and we had a little chat about that. And, it was quite an emotional moment, actually, hearing his stories of being over there and leaving his family at home and the danger he was in and all the rest of it. I mean, I really felt for him. But then that song, you know, resonated with him.
I can relate to that. My father went to the Iraq War as well. He was in the army. Yeah.
Oh, my goodness me.
In terms of the record itself, it was recorded in Montserrat, wasn't it? Out in the Caribbean, you told me before the stories about that and all sort of stuff. But in terms of this track itself, you were recording digitally at this point. It was a very new technology. And did that help with this track, especially with the eerie buildup and everything at the start?
I think that whether it be digital or analog, I don't think it would have made much difference, actually, to be honest. We were experimenting with digital recording, which was very, very new at that particular point in time. So we weren't really, and then we got a dodgy bit of batch of tape at one moment, so which was very awkward because we lost a lot of the initial parts of the recordings at one time. So, you know, it wasn't perfect. Now, obviously, it's all logic and computers and all the rest of it. There's no tape anywhere. But this was digital tape, which you could record about 150 tracks on, and it was, you know, quarter of an inch or something. So anyway, we were experimenting a lot with that record, digitally recording it, and, you know, going to Montserrat was a wonderful experience. Obviously, sadly, it's no longer there. Because of the hurricane and the volcano and everything else, just about everything thrown at it. We finished it off in the power station in New York again. And I think the sound of it is pretty. I mean, we spent a lot of time trying to get the sound right on that record, and thankfully we had great engineers and. We spent a lot of time on it. I think that we knew when we were putting the songs together that we had to get this one right because we, you know, had four albums out and they'd all been pretty successful actually. And then, so we had an audience out there. So I think that, you know, there was an interesting group of songs on there. I mean, some people say, well, there was a pop song on there as well, which was Walk of Life, of course. There was a debate at one point whether we put Walk of Life on their record.
Yeah.
And I put my hand up and said, look, it's an antidote to, you know, Brothers in Arms and all the other serious stuff on there. And this, and I think that, you know, it would really show the level and the depth of what we can do. So, and there was a general agreement. I think one of the engineers said, oh, no, you can't possibly put that on there because it's not serious enough and all the rest of it. Well, what does he know?
Exactly.
Anyway, you have to take chances in this life, like Walk of Life.
You do indeed. Well, John, it's been an absolute pleasure listening to your choices and the reasons behind them. Absolutely fascinating to hear some of the stories behind these great songs. And just a quick recap, there's Brothers in Arms, Telegraph Road, Romeo and Juliet. We've got Six Blade Knife and Wild West End in there as well. Thank you so much for joining us today, John. It's been an absolute pleasure.
My pleasure. Nice to talk to you again.
There you go, the brilliant John Ilsley there, a fascinating dive into the band's catalogue and some really interesting choices and reasons for choosing them too. I have a few more stars who've recorded their five favourites, which will be available in the coming weeks, along with so many other big name guests as well. Anyway, that's it for me and this week's show. Thanks again for listening. Make sure to subscribe on your podcast app so you get all the episodes. They come out every Monday. Please leave a 5-star review on the podcast app that you use. It makes a big difference. It really does. Check out the YouTube channel as well. So many brilliant videos on there. Loads of people following on the channel. But that's it for me then on this week's episode. I'll be back next week, of course, with another big name classic rock star for you. So until then, take care.
It's NFL draft season, and that means it's time to start thinking about fantasy football. FantasyPoints.com features industry-leading experts and prognosticators using proprietary hand-charted data to help you score more fantasy points. FantasyPoints.com is the place to go for whatever kind of fantasy football you play. Whether you play fantasy football, daily fantasy sports, or do a little bit of everything, Fantasy Points has the meticulously researched content to guide you to victory. And why wait for the fall? Fantasy Points also covers the new spring football league, the UFL. Join the guru, John Hansen, Scott Barrett. Joe Dolan, and other massive names in the fantasy football universe with an exclusive offer. Use code Pantheon for 15% off any Fantasy Points package, including the all-in package, with access to every article, tool, and data nugget that Fantasy Points has to offer. That's fantasypoints.com and code Pantheon for 15% off at Fantasy Points. Fantasypoints.com, code Pantheon. Score more fantasy points.